So I'm really delighted that everyone is taking the time to be with us on this wonderful study of the Bodhisattva's way of life, or the way of the Bodhisattva. It's not only a classic text, but it's one of the source texts, one of the foundational texts for all of Buddhist training, and considered one of the six classics that, when they were bringing Buddhism to Tibet, one of the six books that was considered the most important of all the treasures that they brought to Tibet. So it's written by Shantideva, his personal journal in many ways. It's his training, his personal way of training himself. In the first chapter, we really looked at why is loving kindness and compassion and wisdom, why is bodhicitta so significant, so precious, so rare? Why is it that is so important to us that we want to focus on it and train and learn about it? And so this week, having convinced ourselves that it's the best thing we can do with our lives, we look at how do we prepare the ground so that bodhicitta really can arise in our hearts and mind. As I was saying before, the prayer that we often do at the end of practice as part of our dedication, bodhicitta, excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher. That's so familiar with us. And it's a general framework for this text. So we're in the area of now of where it is unborn, may it arise. How do we create the conditions for bodhicitta to arise? And there was a very interesting quote by Atisha that said, for bodhicitta to arise, we need a pure and limpid mind. And I thought, what a curious word, limpid. So interesting. And when I looked it up, it was crystal clear and transparent. So there's a sense of how do we make our mind so clear and transparent that there's nothing shadowing, nothing echoing, totally non-reactive. And it also, I would say, has the quality of being very flexible and peaceful, free, absolutely free. So how do we create a mind that's like that? And at the same time, as we move into it, I want to acknowledge that this chapter, for a lot of people, can bring up the most childhood memories of confusion. Because in this chapter, creating that crystal clear mind, we start talking about offerings and confession. And just the word confession, for those of us who are brought up in the Judeo-Christian tradition, many of the religions had confession, and what we understood as a child that might have been scary and confusing really was not the most profound explanation that that tradition had to offer. Also, in terms of offerings, some of the biblical offerings might have seemed scary to us as a child and confusing stories like Abraham and Isaac. So as a child, that would be hard to understand. So let's acknowledge that we have this cultural view, and we're using the same language. We're using the language, not the Tibetan language or the Sanskrit language that this was written in, but a translation into this same language that have some of the same words that were used to explain these things to us as a child. And so what I'm going to invite you to do is think of it as, okay, it's similar, but now as an adult, you can look through a different prism lens at the ideas of confession. The other tremendously interesting, Shantideva's pep talk to himself, some of the language when we get into the sections on confession use language like, oh evil me, oh sinner, things like that. And so that's a little difficult to relate to in terms of the archaic quality. At the same time, probably most of us occasionally have the thought, I'm such a bad person, cross our minds. You know, so there's we've changed the language in our own inner self to psychological language that's probably equally shocking if someone else could hear how you address yourself sometimes. So it's his personal pep talk. And when we get to that part, I'll talk about more how we can think about the kind of language to make his words accessible to us. But I just want to start out with the view. So the fundamental view of Buddhism is inherent perfection. So the idea of all of this in terms of looking and becoming transparent with ourselves is grounded in the view that we are absolutely perfect, that there is the seed of Buddha in us, but not only is there the seed of our Buddha nature, there is the fully accomplish Buddha within us, and we are getting rid of all of the things that cover that, and we're trying to find a way to shed all of the things that cover that. It's like taking off layers and layers of clothing till we get to that crystal clear mind with no reactivity. I promise you, if you stick with this, there are ways to find it interesting. And if you stick through this chapter, then all the other chapters are just absolutely joyous. But what I find so tremendously interesting is that the wisdom is you have to know what's causing you pain to let go of it. So that's what this chapter accomplishes. Even in the table of contents, this chapter is called Confession, but it's really a lot more than confession. It has some of the most beautiful poetry on offering and generosity that has ever been translated, I think. So it's absolutely gorgeous. Let's go right into things. We are moving into the section on training. And we begin training by contemplating the seven-limb offering, and the six paramitas. So these are two consistent training systems throughout Buddhism. So many, many of the books you read, like the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, it's all about the six paramitas. There's a chapter on each of these, and this is a genre of books called the Lamrim books. And one of the basic tools in all of the practices you do, all of the Vajrayana empowerments you do, is called the seven-limb offering. So if we look at our set of prayers, we have on page 6, 5 lines on the seven-limb offering. So these are considered essentially a distillation of the path. And the first two chapters are arranged on the seven-limb offering concept, which prepares us to make the bodhisattva commitment. And this whole chapter begins with offerings, the first of the seven limbs. And that's a tremendously interesting area. So when Atisha went to Tibet and was preparing to give the Bodhisattva vow, he kept saying, well, you need to make offerings for me to create the conditions for me to offer this vow. And he was trying to teach this whole new culture the concept of making offerings and celebrating and accumulating the good open heart and the heart that wants to value the teachings. And so he made them do it 3 times because they didn't quite get how precious and valuable this treasure was. And these stories are fairly common in the Tibetan storytelling from the sense that the teacher will keep saying, but you say this is important to you, you say this is a treasure, but you left behind the goat. You're not really offering everything. So it's a sense of helping us to understand and value. So someone comes with a giant bag of gold, for instance, to Milarepa, and gives essentially everything they have. But the key teaching is then Milarepa throws the gold into the air. He doesn't need the gold. He doesn't want the gold. He has no use for the gold. He wants the student to come in prepared to understand that the teachings that lead you to enlightenment are the most precious that you will ever receive, the most in your whole life, more valuable than anything. And so it's a way of opening up to how important and significant the teachings are. So I find it tremendously interesting to contemplate generosity, interesting in that it's always the first of all of the trainings. And over time, you start to see how profound it is. You start to see what the connection of giving away is to your grasping onto your self-protection. How much do you feel you need to be safe? And what is safe, this non-existing self? So we have this illusion of self, and we want to keep it safe, and we want to protect it. So we have these layers of things that make everything okay that we're afraid to let anything impinge upon. So, for instance, this summer we were cleaning out the basement and we were taking stuff to the dump and we were taking stuff to Goodwill. And you know how it is. You have everything. The truck is there to go Goodwill and you run out and grab something back. Something you haven't used in 10 years. Maybe one day I will need this. So there's a sense of first looking at you know, where your boundaries are and then softening those boundaries, because it becomes a key for you to look at yourself every time you want to hold on to something. And I love some of the teachers who make it like a game. Like, for instance, Pema Chodron, when she's teaching about the Bodhisattva vow, like Atisha in that Sangha, they say you should give something very valuable, something that hurts a little to give when you're taking that vow. And she says immediately or very publicly that she will give everything away. So you see how invested you are in selecting the thing and that she will like it and want to keep it. You know, so there's a sense of wanting some attention from the teacher because of this valuable, precious offering that you're making. So you start to see a whole layer of all the kinds of things you start to think about just by giving away fairly, it's not your house, it's not your car, fairly simple things. So Shantideva starts really spectacular poetry, and he thinks about, you can see him imagining all the most beautiful things in the world that he can offer. He was a monk. He lived in a tiny little cubicle in Nalanda when he was writing this. And I'm looking at verse 2 through 6. I offer every variety of fruit and flower and every kind of healing medicine, each and every jewel this world affords with its pure waters of refreshment, every mountain rich and filled with jewels, all sweet and lonely forest groves, trees of heaven garlanded with blossoms and branches heavy laden with their fruit, the perfumed fragrance of the realms of gods and men, all incense, wishing trees and trees of gems, all crops that grow without the tiller's care, and every sumptuous object worthy to be offered. Lakes and mares adorned with lotuses, all plaintive with the sweet voice cries of water birds, and lovely to the eyes, and all things wild and free, stretching to the boundless limits of the sky. I hold them all before my mind, and to the supreme Buddhas and to their heirs will make a perfect gift of them. Oh, think of me with love, compassionate lords, sacred object of my prayers, accept these offerings. So the first layer is just thinking of the physical material world, all the wonderful things you can imagine, you know, all the seasons, the beauty of the greenness of spring, of the fall colors, of the pristine white snow up here, just everything you can imagine. And these actually have quite a bit of significance in that if you look at the actual offerings, he's offering from all the different senses, all the different sense groups. And each sense group has a corresponding afflictive emotion that it's the antidote for. So when we're offering things we see, it's the antidote for ignorance. Offering things we hear, it's the antidote for hatred. Things that we smell, antidote for pride. Things that we taste, antidote for desire. Things that we touch, antidote for jealousy. So there's a way of understanding the deeper meaning of the beautiful objects that he's offering. But these are still, at a very material level, there's still a sense of an object, someone who's offering, and the object one is offering to, or the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, so that we would call these the surpassable offerings. When we start to move into the realm of unsurpassable offerings, then there's no sense of I making an offering to a Buddha or the object there is. There's a sense of emptiness mixed into all of it, or the illusory nature mixed into all of the offerings. So you see where we are thinking, I want to offer this fabulous cup of tea to the Dalai Lama, to the illusory being. Offering illusory tea to the illusory Dalai Lama is where we want to get to. There's a tremendous training in making the offerings, in the sense of when we're offering to something to someone like the Dalai Lama, we're training in love and devotion. You know, our admiration, our gratitude, our heart is just opening. So there's that fabulous training in relation to the wise beings and wise teachers of our time. And then when we're offering to those who are in need and those who are in tremendous pain, there's the sense of offering of compassion, that we're training in compassion continuously as we're making those kinds of offerings. So there's such a richness in making offerings. And then at the next layer, he does a spectacular visualization. So you have to imagine India, and you have to imagine his cubicle, and it's dry, hot, and dusty. And even now in India, I've been 6 times, what you really want is a beautiful, clean bathroom. Believe me, after a week, it's hot, it's dusty. And so culturally in India, there's the tradition of offering guests, you would wash their feet as they came in your house. And still in the monastic tradition, when you go out on begging grounds, when you come back, the junior monks wash the feet of the senior monks. So there's a sense of one of the most fabulous things, a beautiful, luxurious, clean bathroom. And he's imagining all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and he's imagining this elaborate, like he had been a prince. And so the most beautiful craftsmanship, marble, crystal bathtub, fabulous clean water. You know, in India, you would get the water from the rivers that wasn't always clean, so it would have to be strained and everything before you would offer it in the bathroom. And what's coded in those verses on this incredible bathtub scene is that, you know, it's really the most elaborate bathroom imaginable in the verses. What's coded in there is the tradition of bathing the Buddhas. That we see is celebrated in lots of different parts of Asia, is when the Buddhas bathe, Vajrasattva, the water then goes out to everyone and cleanses everybody's mind. So it cleanses all of your afflictive emotions after the bathing. Offer the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas these beautiful soft towels. What's coded in there is that when you offer the soft towels, that then everything that's dried up from the, you know, mopping up the last bit of water from the Buddha's body becomes a red ray of light that goes right to the center of your forehead, and it's skill accomplishment of the wisdom of the Buddha coming to you and all sentient beings. So on the surface, you have this gorgeous poetry about the most beautiful bathing circumstance, and then under the surface is a visualization of all of our neurotic craziness being cleansed, as well as wisdom coming to the centers of our mind. And then after that, more offerings are made of, you know, when we see the tankas, we see all the different ways that people were dressed. So there were people in monk's robes, and then there were people in prince robes with all kinds of beautiful jewelry on. And there's a reference to Samantabhadra's offerings. And each of the bodhisattvas were considered to have perfected some aspect of the Buddhist path. And Samantabhadra perfected offerings. And when we think of Samantabhadra's offering, from every pore in his body, a ray of light is going out, and from that ray of light, a beautiful offering goddess is appearing, and then she has in her hands the most fabulous everything of chocolate cakes and gems and everything. And so all of this is being offered to all of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So there's a teaching in here from what we can see to what we can imagine to the most wild imagination possible of imagining every conceivable perfect recipient and making hundreds of thousands of offerings from every pore of your body. So it takes us through a whole sequence of offerings. And then as we learn about that and as we start to train in that, then we start back in our simple way of just making simple offerings, seeing where our boundaries are, where that clinging to some sort of safety and protection comes up, and then letting us pay attention to that and soften that, and then go ahead and then offer more the next time, the next time, and the next time. So it becomes a beautiful practice at the down-to-earth level, as well as you're moving through the world and seeing beautiful things, a sense of, I can offer this right now. I can see the first snow on the mountain. I offer that pristine snowfall. And so that softens over time our heart, our protective system. And then we have a series of verses that talk about how to become transparent. How do we actually acknowledge where we are? We're starting to see where we are when we're seeing when we want to not make an offering. So how do we acknowledge on a big scale, what is our confusion? so that we can then address that confusion. We want to see our confusion. It's a little frightening to want that, but we want to be able to see what it is that's the obstacle to our wisdom. So based on a confidence in our perfection, our basic goodness, or our inner Buddha nature, we look at the stages of becoming transparent. So the first stage is simply recognition. I recognize when I act like this, I'm unhappy with myself. I am causing difficulty, confusion, pain towards others, and I'm causing actually pain to myself. And that's the basic recognition, to understand that any of our actions that are negative not only are harming others, but are harming ourselves. So we have the recognition and then reliance on our basic goodness. And then applying a remedial action or opposing power, and then resolve to change our neurotic patterns. So these are the four stages that all of these verses work through. So this is a very interesting concept to look at as an adult and as a spiritual practice, because it's not about guilt. And it's not about somehow wallowing in, I'm bad, I'm bad, I'm bad. That's actually self-aggression, which is another kind of aggression. So we're not trying to be aggressive with ourselves, we're trying to be gentle with ourselves. So the thought is to recognize the confusion you have, the difficulty you have, the obscuring neurotic pattern that you have, and not to soften it, to recognize it as it is, but rather than sliding into guilt, which we as a culture are very expert at. The Tibetans say it's one of the things we're really good at. Instead of sliding into guilt, we slide towards our Buddha nature and say, okay, my Buddha nature, my inherent perfection is there. I want to move towards that. So I want to move towards acting differently, right? So we recognize that the guilt or the self-aggression is another negative pattern. So it doesn't have anything to do with recognition. Recognition is just being honest and transparent. Then relying on the Buddha nature, and then Shantideva will give us some incredible logic in this chapter as to why we want to change our patterns and how we can think about changing our patterns, and then we resolve to change our patterns. You see that sequence? The thought is, with the recognition, in combination with confidence in our Buddha nature, there's a confidence that we can change our patterns, and that change of our patterns leads to peace of mind and mental freedom, which is why we want to go that direction, which creates this unclouded, unshadowed mind that is ready to move towards actualizing our bodhisattva capacity. So it has nothing to do with guilt and nothing to do with shame, more to do with, I see it, I'm going to teach myself the Dharma so that I can move out of this pattern, and I'm going to make a fresh start in the next moment. I found it very interesting in these verses even to look at several different translations just to see if we can take the language out of the childhood religious language a little bit. I understand that the translators were tasked with a couple of different things. They wanted it to have a strong impact at the same time, not causing the reaction of guilt and our childish understanding. But if we look now, we're at verse 28. Trungpa looked at words like evil and sin and experimented with the word neurotic crimes. Khenchen Khonsa Galsin experimented with the word confusion. Some of the confession ceremonies that we work with as monks and nuns work with the world's childishness, heedlessness, mindlessness. So there's a whole way of saying ignorance. In a state of ignorance, I did things I wish I didn't do. And verse 28, overwhelmed by ignorant delusion, I celebrated the harm that was done in this and all my other countless lifetimes spent wandering in beginningless samsara. And then your translation, in this and all my other lifetimes wandering in the round without beginning, blindly I have brought forth wickedness, inciting others to commit the same. This is the same translation group working with the same verse. But the sense is, in samsara, held by all of our previous actions, we're continuing to make mistakes. So in our ignorance, or we are blind to what we're doing in that moment, or we would make a different choice, right? In that moment, with all the factors in our situation, we make a blind choice instead of a mindful choice. This continues the process of rebirth after rebirth in confusion. He's emphasizing the ignorant or blind quality and the overall view of samsara continuing until we wake up. I have taken pleasure in such evil, tricked and overmastered by my ignorance. Now I see the blame of it, O great protectors, I declare it. In my ignorance I have committed wrongs and encouraged others, but now I see it was all done in error, and before the Buddhas I sincerely confess. So I love some of the language, tricked and overmastered. So you have that sense about our ignorance in the moment, tricking us and overmastering us. We can all relate to that. I know my favorite example is chocolate of every form, but like tricked, tricked in the moment. The beauty of that chocolate bar, then another pound goes on. It's the ignorance of the desire of that chocolate every single time, you know, you fall for it. It's like Lucy and the Charlie Brown and the football. You're tricked by your ignorance, making choices. And I just want to give you some of the language of some of the other translators. Simply right here, whatever evil was committed by me, an animal, or caused to be committed, and whatever was enjoyed foolishly, ending in self-destruction, that evil I confess, stricken with remorseful feeling. So again, it's about recognition, absolute recognition. And we often have no sense, because the nature of ignorance is that we are blind to some of our behaviors. And that's why this is so important. One of the retreats I was in a couple of years ago, all of a sudden, in the middle of retreat, it was a perfectly nice, peaceful retreat, a spotlight went on in my mind. Just, it was like a searchlight. And all of a sudden, all the actions I had done probably for years that I had hidden from myself became apparent. And I realized it was shocking at the time. I mean, I didn't kill anybody, but our capacity to hide our faults from ourselves should not be underestimated. And the wonderful nature of prajna, or our wisdom, is that all of a sudden we see what we were blind to before. The other thing that's wonderful or significant about this confession is that it emphasizes declaring openly. So there's that sense of not wanting to preserve one's pride, one's reputation. There's a sense of wanting to be open with yourself and wanting to be open to the Buddhas. So essentially, it's like going to the doctor and saying, I know I have an illness. You know, I feel this pain here in my heart. Please help me. In the monastic training, when we're working with our bi-monthly confession, Pema would encourage us to sit with someone else and to just talk about what was difficult for us. What are the, you know, teeny tiny little things we were doing, just to get in the practice of being open, not trying to preserve our ego in any kind of way. And again, that leads to more and more freedom. You have nothing to hide, nothing to worry about. You only want to shed ignorance and encourage and help other people to shed their ignorance. So some of the other language from the other translators, overwhelmed by the deceptions of ignorance, seeing these mistakes, whatever harmful acts of body, speech, and mind I have done in a disturbed state of mind, I openly declare. So we're acknowledging being overwhelmed by our self-deception, acknowledging that we, of course, our inner perfection wants only to benefit people. So in a disturbed state of mind, caught up by the desire of the chocolate, is a disturbed state of mind. We openly declare. Another translation, the line from Stephen Batchelor, and anything I have deludedly rejoiced in. Some politician we don't agree with makes a terrible mistake, and we rejoice. You know, we have that sense of rejoicing in someone else's misfortune. So there's not only what we do, but how we think. Heike is saying, the quality we have of I have taken pleasure in is one of the lines of the verses. So you see how the translators are walking a thin line, trying to preserve in an intact way Shantideva's own pep talk to himself in his cultural time, make it in language that we can have access to without steering us into our guilt, and then pulling us back to, and where do we want to go from here? We want to go towards a different freedom, freedom from our neurotic patterns. So verses 30 through 33, again, all the different kinds of things that Shantideva wants to declare. And then we look at 32, before my evil has been cleansed away, it may be that my death will come to me. And so, come what may, I might be freed, I pray you, quickly grant me your protection. So that, again, there's a sense that life is short and we want to be free before we die. The wanton lord of death we can't predict, and life's task done or still to do we cannot stay. And whether ill or well we cannot trust, our lives are fleeting momentary lives. A week ago or 2 weeks ago, I was sitting with someone while they were dying, and it's always incredible to contemplate our fleeting momentary lives. To watch this person struggle to let go of their patterns, even in the moments before death, and how hard that was, how much they wanted to let go of patterns and how difficult it was. Visibly, her life was fleeting. It was momentary. It was the time of her dying. So we have right now the capacity to work with our minds, and we don't know whether we'll wake up tomorrow. So our fleeting momentary lives. One of Shantideva's expertness in his poetry is describing why he wants to change and giving us the logic underpinning the emotional quality of wanting so much to have the mental freedom and capacity to change. So verse 34, and we must pass away forsaking all, but I, devoid of understanding, have for the sake of friends and foe alike provoked and brought about so many evils. Here we are, knowing that when we die, we're alone. When we think of how we want to protect our friends and we want our enemies not to succeed, they're not going to be with us when we die. So we've done so many things for, because of friends and enemies. And what meaning do those actions have when it comes to the time of death, when we want to be able to relax into the Dharmakaya wisdom or the limpid, non-reactive, crystal clear mind. My enemies will become no more. My friends and I myself will cease to be. All is likewise destined for destruction. The house that you're working so hard on, you know, the will cease to be. You can't take it. It's not going to go with you. My friends and I myself, one of the great teachings a long time ago, I think it might have been Thich Nhat Hanh, if you're having an argument with someone, imagine 300 years from now, who will really care about the subject of the argument? All that I possess and use is like the fleeting vision of a dream. It fades into the realm of memory, and fading will be seen no more. Everything that we possess, everything that we use, you know, that we want to grasp onto, that we want to hold, that we think is so precious, gone, absolutely gone. And even in the brief course of this present life, so many friends and foes have passed away, because of whom the evils I have done still lie unbearable before me. So when we think of maybe harsh words, for instance, you know, even in the heat of an argument towards someone who might have terribly wronged you, that person may be totally gone. But your feeling of, I wish I could have been kind in that moment, or I wish I hadn't hurt that person, or I wish I hadn't yelled at my mother, and now she's not here. You know, so there's that sense of we carry. So we want to be free from all of those burdens that we're carrying. And so this is his way of helping us start to see that all of our actions hurt our own heart. You know, at the most basic, the positive selfishness that the Dalai Lama talks about, even if we aren't at the point that we can be concerned with every living being as precious, we can at least start to see that we're harming ourselves when we do these kinds of actions. The thought came never to my mind that I too am a brief and passing thing. And so though through hatred, lust, and ignorance, I've been the cause of many evils. Never halting day or night, my life is always slipping by, and nothing that has passed can be regained. And what but death could be my destiny? There I'll be, prostrate upon my bed, and all around the ones I know and love. But I alone shall be the one to feel the cutting of the thread of life. So he's giving us perspective. We want that open, relaxed mind at the moment of death. We want peace at the moment of death. We want to be able to see everyone around us with love. We want to have opened our hearts. You know, all the family arguments are not important. This one that you've always fought with, or that one that's always been difficult. The moment of death, you're only going to want peace between you and that person. So he's helping us to really look at the bigger picture. Now, he goes on for several verses being frightened about death, which some of the language is, again, a little archaic. But if we move to verse 47, he takes refuge again. So this goes back onto the support, the reliance. And it's interesting, there'll be refuge a couple of times throughout the text. It was in the first chapter too, but this refuge is focused on the Dharma as the principal aspect of refuge. So we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, and here we're taking refuge primarily in the Dharma because we're using the Dharma to teach ourselves at this point. We want to put it into practice in our lives. And so we're really looking at what are the instructions that can help me change these neurotic patterns. Thus, from this day forth, I go for refuge to Buddhas, guardians of wandering beings, who labor for the good of all that lives, those mighty ones who scatter every fear. And I think that's an important line in the sense that we want fearlessness. Peace of mind and fearlessness go together. Fearlessness in terms of not being afraid to look inward transparently, and fearlessness knowing that all beings like ourselves have the same sufferings, fearlessness in letting go of the self-absorbed view to looking towards all sentient beings and what they need. In the Dharma that resides within the hearts and scatters all the terrors of samsara, and in the multitude of bodhisattvas, likewise I will perfectly take refuge. So now we can go to verse 54, and this is a beautiful, particularly beautiful sequence, and it refers to seeing the Buddha and the Dharma as physician and medicine. So this is one of the classic sets of verses that's repeated in many, many texts because Shantideva put it so beautifully. For, if alarmed by common ills, I act according to the doctor's words, what need is there to speak when I'm constantly brought low by lust and all the hundreds of other torments? One of the new translations that I like of our afflictive emotions, of jealousy, anger, hatred, all of those emotions that we don't like so much, is torture. It's something that tortures our mind. We want to be free of all the things that torture our mind. If we go to the doctor for a common cold, what need is there to speak of going to Dharma for the medicine for torture, self-torture? And if by one of these alone, the dwellers in the world are all thrown down. So we see that it's essentially human to have jealousy, to have desire, to have anger. So everyone has these emotions. And no other remedy exists, no other healing elsewhere to be found than the words of the omniscient physician uprooting every ill and suffering. Then the thought to turn on him deaf ears is raving folly. Wretched and contemptible. So, this is the part I really like, the raving folly, wretched and contemptible. So again, this is Shantideva talking to himself. But here we are, we see that we're tortured by some of our emotions. We see that everybody is tortured by their emotions. Everybody is tortured by different kinds of addictions. And our understanding of the significance of the Dharma is that as we pass through the training, we actually uproot those things so that they never appear again. And if this truth is what the Buddha is able to actually demonstrate so that we can do it ourselves, we would be raving folly, wretched, and contemptible not to pay attention, right? It's a beautiful metaphor to think of. How we torture ourselves is like poison within our body, and the Buddha is the doctor. But the Buddha that we actually access in the here and now is the Dharma itself. So it's encouraging us to really study and think and to follow through with some of Shantideva's logic. So he was presenting that our lives are fleeting and momentary. And as we progress through the next series of chapters, he gives the actual training to uproot the things that torture us. Now, verse 58, "Today at least I shall not die. So rash to lull myself with words like these. My dissolution and my hour of death will come upon me in electulibi. Why am I so unafraid? For what escape is there for me? Death, my death, will certainly come round, so how can I relax in careless ease? Of life's experience, all seasons past, what's left for me, what now remains? By clinging to what is now is here no more, my teacher's precepts I have disobeyed. This life, the span of life and all it contains, my kith and kin are all to be abandoned. I must leave them, setting out to alone. What grounds are there for telling friend from foe? And therefore, how can I make sure to rid myself of evil, the only cause of sorrow? This should be why my one concern, my only thought, both day and night." So back to 58. We say, as we procrastinate continuously, "Today at least I shall not die." I can study that book tomorrow. I can do meditation tomorrow. Today at least I shall not die. And having just been at the bedside of someone who's dying, you know, we just don't want to look at the fact that that's going to be us soon. You know, we don't know when, but definitely is going to be us one day. So why is it that we relax saying it's not today? And then of life's experience, of all the seasons, everything that you've ever experienced, no matter how wonderful, is gone now. And based on our clinging to what we think is wonderful, we've done all kinds of things that maybe have been a little foolish. And all our dear ones will be no more. The enemies will be no more. We've learned from our dear ones. We've learned from our enemies. Is there really any distinction since ourselves, our dear ones, and our enemies all have Buddha nature? In the same way that we're confused, our enemies have been confused. Do we really want to make enemies? They're confused beings who've experienced mental disturbed moments just as we have. So how do we distinguish really friend from foe? So the point of all of this is the last two lines of 62. And I'm going to again work with another or a couple of versions of translation to rid myself of unwholesomeness, unmindfulness, the only cause of sorrow. Or another way, sorrow is caused by the unmindfulness. Sorrow is caused by the disturbed state. So letting go of this disturbed state, this should be my only concern, my only thought, both day and night. And we progress from there. So we're acknowledging in this chapter that we have fleeting momentary lives, and that we often are confused. We want to use a kind of pragmatic intelligence, is the way Pema Chodron discusses it, a pragmatic intelligence to have a more mindful, attentive, tender caring for ourselves and others, so that we're not harming others and we're not harming ourselves. Again, the view is that we are perfect and we're letting go of the layers of the disturbances. We're doing it step by step. So one of the first layers of letting go of the self-absorbed or self-centered view is by the practice of generosity. Then we start to see easily where our withholding comes from. And that recognizing it in that state makes it easier for us to then see it in all of the other states that we work with in the confession verses. And what I found very interesting contemplating the chapter this year was the beautiful set of offerings. He was offering everything in the world. In the next chapter, he's let go of some of the sense of, I am offering this, and he's saying, may I become the medicine. May I become the pure water. May I become the bridge. And then by the final chapter, he's saying, there's no difference at all in terms of myself and others. there's only a beingness in this illusory quality of all of these interdependent things. No I to become, just the aspiration of this open heart of may all beings be free from suffering, again in the most exquisite poetry. So you made it through this chapter, which has some of the kinds of things that are a little scary and the kinds of things that may provoke echoes from the past. And so if you can take in from this chapter is a way to become honest with yourselves without guilt and beginning the training to change the way you torture yourself and harm yourself, to change anything that's self-destructive. The first step has to be seeing it in order to change. So once seeing it, once acknowledging that our lives are short and we want an open, peaceful, free state of mind, then we're all going to make the commitment to train. And the commitment, the next series of chapters, the next four or five chapters, are just fabulous. Then we get to patience, which is hard again, wisdom, which is very hard, and then fabulous again. We have some time before we dedicate the merit for questions. And there may be questions here and maybe questions. We can go into question mode. Are there any questions here? I think it must, Dajin is asking about the verses on offering and the commentaries. Was he aware of all of the, what I was saying, were coded on the inside? And I think probably both. And so on the one hand, many of the things originated, like the Bodhisattva vow originated in his writing. And some of the things are sort of accepted commentaries, and I don't know when they became accepted commentaries. Like if you think of the beautiful offering prayer from Lord Jigten Sumgun, the Ser Kangma, when he talks about the goddesses holding fragrant offerings and that this is the goddess that purifies pride. They're accepted conventions of each of the five senses. So when that became standard convention, I don't know. But I was thinking about it in terms of when we got to the visualization that went with the bath. And I'll find out when that commentary was written. But I wondered myself if, like Tonglin, if, you know, he introduces the verses on Tonglin that become the beginning of that teaching as well. So many of the verses have this incredible teaching that's grown up around them. When that happened at the time he said it or not, I don't really know. Jean, are you there?
I am. I wondered if you could just say again the antidote to the different senses of sight, smell, taste, and hearing.
Oh, okay. So Jean is asking what are the relationships between the offerings as antidotes to the senses. Offerings that have to do with things we see is the antidote to ignorance. Things we hear is the antidote to hatred. Like incense, things we smell is the antidote to pride. Things we taste is the offering that is the antidote to desire. And things we touch is the antidote to jealousy. So these are the five senses and the ignorance that they're overcoming.
Thank you. And the other thing that I noted in just reading ahead on this and hearing you talk about it this morning is just what I've been trying to do is just as I go through my day and I see beautiful things to just make it as an offering.
Yes.
And it just gives that little moment of awareness in the, you know, during a busy day.
That's lovely. So Gene is saying his beautiful offering, everything he's seeing and experiencing as well as everything he can imagine. In a busy day, it becomes a really fun way of making offerings. For a moment, you see the blue sky. Oh, I offer that. Do we have another question, Barbara? Okay, Paula?
Namaste, and thank you so much for the teachings. In regards to becoming aware of your own ignorance, is there a method or a practice or prayers that I could use or that could be used to shine light on those spaces where I'm not seeing my own ignorance?
Absolutely. So Paula is asking about what are the practices for becoming aware of your own ignorance. So one of the, and prayers. In this book, when we get to the alertness and awareness chapter 4 in particular, and vigilance 5, center on how absolutely to become aware, and then chapter 6, patience, is then what to do once you're aware. They really are just tremendously valuable. And this is why the chapters alone become subjects of books and teachings. Each chapter individually could be considered a complete training and practice. And then in general, the Heart Sutra is a little, the Dalai Lama was joking, he was teaching about it. He was saying he likes to call it the Hard Sutra. The Hard Sutra, the Dalai Lama. But that is one of the great contemplations for overcoming our ignorance of the nature of our minds and the nature of reality. So even reciting that when you don't totally understand it then leads you to become interested in some of the commentaries and some of the books about it and gradually understanding it more and more. So those are good places to start. And really this whole book, if you follow all the way through, just leads you so beautifully to more and more depth of wisdom. With his wonderful sense of humor, raving folly. I love those comments when he's talking to himself of what a fool he is. It's really an interesting thing. It really is a tremendous, tremendous training, isn't it? For those on the phone line, a wonderful friend is talking about giving away a really wonderfully functional drying rack and how, you know, it pops up in her mind. So it's amazing. The silliest things you can see provoke this I want or I need. Just to see how nuts it can be. You know how when people go on a beach and they take a walk and they find one precious stone on the beach and then they don't want to give it away or leave it behind? You know, all of a sudden it's my rock, as though it's the memory of that day. And so the trainings that we keep going with in this help you analyze that ordinary thing. Will it have value on your deathbed? It won't. So why are you holding on to it now? That kind of thing. So as we go through the different chapters, there will be these wonderful logics. And that's what I particularly appreciate about him. We have an emotional response and we have an aspiration, and then he gives you like a step-by-step. When you're in this, when this problem is occurring, just run this through your mind. Is it this? Is it this? Is it this? And no, no, no. And it helps you let go. And you just sort of wear it away. The practice of offerings continues through many chapters and even continues through the end, because it's a signal of dissolving our focus on ourselves. So there's one famous line is until you can give something away like it was a cabbage, then you see you haven't really let go of it. Even the most precious thing has to be like an ordinary cabbage, and a cabbage is the cheapest thing in the market in India. We eat it all year long. But when it becomes like, you know, if you have 600 squashes in your garden, and you can give it away so easily, or all the flowers in your garden that you can give away so easily. Starting with that and noticing the freedom of that, and then working on when there's a tug, how do you get to the same mental freedom at each level of what's difficult? So you're going for freedom. Okay, so the person on the phone?
Oh, hi, this is Ann Lucas.
Hey, hi, Ann.
I was thinking about the things you talked about, and as the antidotes to various things. And so this is an idea, and I wanted to ask if this was correct thinking. And that is, we talked about if you see something beautiful, that you offer it. Mm-hmm. Would you then want to seek to see beautiful things as an offering? Would you want to chant mantras or as beautiful music as an offering to be an antidote to hate? Would you want to, you know, have incense in your home, again, to have an offering as an antidote to pride? Would you want to cultivate mindful eating so that you could offer that taste? And if you have the comfort of a warm shower, would you want to offer that as an antidote to jealousy? I mean, I was thinking about practical practices and how I would offer these as antidotes to these things we talked about.
So Anne was asking a really good question. She was talking about making offerings. Then how do we put this practice into everyday life? And do we want to use every opportunity to make offerings, essentially? And the answer is yes. And the key is when we're making the offerings, we want to make the offerings intentionally, and we want to make it intentionally to open our hearts and minds to create the spaciousness for bodhicitta, right? And if we talk about bodhicitta as ultimate bodhicitta, the sense of openness and spaciousness and mixed with emptiness, so not attachment to I making the offering of the object. We start with absolutely anything. One of the first trainings we give people is how to offer water on the altar. And there's a sense when you're making the offering of the water on the altar, for that moment you're really paying attention. You're paying attention as you pour it. You're paying attention that it's clear, fresh water. You're paying attention that you fill it. And so it's not just pouring the water. It's may my mind and heart be opened by this offering. And then because you're mindful, you can add on things all of the time. So the water is fresh and sweet and fragrant and not harmful to the stomach. So you start to think of all of the qualities of the water that you're offering. It gets to the point where you offer even the shape of the water falling into the water bowl. Like when Kenshin describes an offering, he talks about making this beautiful shape of a, I'm thinking of a needle at the moment, you know, a beautiful shape. And it leads you, the levels of mindfulness become a practice so that then you're offering a glass of water to a guest. Because you've trained in one mindful offering, then you can offer to a guest in that way. I remember Venerable Tahani teaches an incredible a level of caretaking teachers when they come to visit. We were having some training somewhere, and I remember her just deciding that the way she would teach us would be offering each of us a glass of water. And so the beautiful manners and the way she held everything was like a Japanese ritual. And the quality of kindness that she put in the intention of handing each of us that glass of water just came through so strongly. So you start to see any action you take when you are working with this level of mindfulness becomes an offering. And as you train the different layers, then you can start training when you're ready in the emptiness aspect of it. So you can keep building on the simplest act till every act becomes profound meditation. And so that is some of the trainings that are wonderful come in the chapter on awareness for how to train in mindfulness at that level. But the intention is the most significant part. May we become enlightened in order to benefit beings. May we open our hearts, not to become, you know, a superstar, but to become profoundly kind to all living things. So Jan is talking about looking at this process in the office, and I would like to even take it a step further. Jana is somebody who's doing some really incredible work. So essentially, you are offering your body to assuage the suffering of these people that you're working with. And so cleaning your office is creating a way to better serve the enlightened activities of all of the Buddhas. It's some of the lines that we didn't read out loud, some of the verses are of offering the body to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the sense of, may I be in service of your activities. Jen is talking about a cluttered office, and I'm thinking about my cluttered desk. How can we have a clear thought? Yes. Yeah, that's right. And that's why the teachers talk about the Bodhisattva activity of preparing for the teachings, all the cleaning of the space and the cleaning of the temple and, you know, getting everything ready so that everyone can have the circumstances for the teachings to arrive. Some of the verses on offerings, I mean, there's always much more than depth in every single verse, but there are whole verses on creating the circumstances for the teachings to arise. So it's like setting up the grounds and imagining the rain of flowers falling because he's imagining the most miraculous teachings. And when the miraculous teachings happen, then all of these things are going on at the same time with the rain of flowers and things like that. So he's visualizing everybody having the fruits of the circumstances of the most wonderful teachings arising. So there was a wonderful, wonderful Drikung Lama, Drubwang Rinpoche, who was a very elderly, could barely walk. But he did a whole international tour so he could sponsor His Holiness Chensang Rinpoche giving fabulous teachings. I think it might have been the first Snake Year teachings that he sponsored. And he just decided he would create the circumstances. So as difficult as it would have been for him to travel, he invited all of our generosity to help create the beginning of these annual teachings in the Drikun lineage. So yes, the verses that are in the next chapter are, okay, we've agreed that bodhicitta's mental freedom, mental peace, and the arising kindness in that spaciousness is the most precious thing in life. We have to look at what we want to let go of so our minds can be like that. Then we commit to walking on the path, and then we commit to this training in heightened mindfulness. And then we commit to, no matter what happens, I'm going to keep going. And then he has the whole chapter of what to do when you're in trouble. The patience chapter. So it's really incredibly presented. Okay, Tanya.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, you spoke of the practice of generosity as the first layer, and you also spoke about being honest with ourselves, you know, in reference to and recognizing our neurotic crimes. So I want to be able to understand how the practice of generosity relates to acknowledge neurotic crimes. Is that we acknowledge, we recognize, and then we take that leap, as Pema Chodron says, in applying the antidote, that the relationship, am I understanding this correctly?
Yes, and let me just see if I can go a little further. So Tanya's asking about the relationship between generosity and confession. In this sense, we're talking about a specific theory. So we're talking about the seven-limb offering. And I'm just going to read our very short prayer. Whatever merit I've gathered through prostrations, offering, confession, rejoicing, beseeching, and praying. So the offerings and the confession are two sequences in a series of things that help us turn towards the positive. We would say accumulating merit and understanding our minds, which would be accumulating wisdom. So the offering part is a positive action, and the acknowledging our faults is a way of learning how to see what the blocks are. So they're slightly different from each other, and they're in a series of trainings that go together very regularly. In the teaching on confession, there are four parts to it. In the four parts, the remedy or antidote part is doing positive actions, and then generosity would be one of those actions in the antidote as well. And they both work on softening our attachment to our self-centered perspective. So they go together, but not necessarily directly together. They're like two wheels on a bicycle. They're both going. Is that helpful, Tanya?
Yes, it did. Thank you. Okay. I have a little better understanding of it now.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, we have two more questions on the phone.
Hello.
Hi.
I have two questions. Mm-hmm. One is, I have the book. However, some of my verses are very different from the ones you're reading. Mm-hmm. Do I need to get the book that matches your verses exactly? Many of them I can, some of them I can follow, and they're not exactly, but they're similar. Others are written so differently that I feel, you know, after the call, I really need to go back and compare what you read to what my verse says, and I wonder, should I just get a different edition? It's the Padmakara translation, but it must be a different year or something.
Yes. We're asking about the translations, and it's very interesting. I like reading actually all the translations because it gives you insight to how difficult translation is to present concepts, and they have slightly different nuances. So if it doesn't bother you that the book is different, then not to worry about it. What's interesting about the earlier Padmakara translation is they felt they wanted to improve it. So their view as translators was that they could make the meaning a little more clear. But even so, when I was looking at some of the verses on confession, I found that I like some of their earlier translation better. So we just thank them and realize it's not an easy job to translate.
Okay. Another question I have is regarding when you were describing these vast bathrooms,
mm-hmm.
and you talked about coded levels.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of missed some of that. Could you just go over a little bit about the coded levels?
Okay. She's asking about the fabulous bathroom part of the offering. So
yes.
He's actually taking us through lots of levels of offerings. And so he's starting with the things we see around us and offering the things we see around us. And even those he's enhancing by not things that we necessarily own, but like what's available, the natural world. And then he talks about offering the body and becoming in service to the Buddhas and in service to their mission. And then he talks about these incredible visualizations, which are more not what he sees, but more like fantasies. Right, so like a dream, like he wants to even imagine something more wonderful than the natural world. The commentary that was giving the teaching about this is called Nectar of Manjushri Speech, and it's one of the major commentaries on this work that's been translated. So there are actually hundreds of commentaries on this text by the Tibetans. And so each of these incredible masters, just as Shantideva has been teaching himself, they're taking his journal, essentially, and then teaching themselves and making an overlay with their best intelligence about how they are working with it. And so in the commentary, they were talking about imagining the bathroom, and a whole practice has evolved around this in Asia, particularly the Japanese, I think. There's a whole ceremonial day that's devoted to bathing the Buddha. And so on the outside, the Buddha statue is being bathed. And actually, this is done in India with some of the really incredible statues. It's believed if you bathe the statue, because the relics are in the statue and the Buddhas have promised to be in the statue through the consecration ceremonies, that the water that touches it, they make into medicine. So there's a sense of the bathing then also becoming medicine for vast numbers of beings, however vastly we can imagine, I and all sentient beings, that the water drains out of the bathtub and comes into us, bathing our crazy minds into sane minds. And then all these beautiful cloths are offered to do the final drying of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And that in this commentary, the towels then dissolve into a red light which comes to the center of our forehead as receiving all the wisdom accomplishments. So it's actually wonderful to think of these incredible people over time contemplating these verses and taking them into their hearts and then feeling the confidence to practice with them. So that's what I'd like to encourage you to do. Like, how would you imagine offerings? How would you imagine the most vast offerings that you could make? What would that look like to you? Samantabhadra has every pore admitting light, you know, and that going out like as though there were Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Like here in Vermont at the night, we can see millions of stars. So it's like they were all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and the light is going out making offerings. And here we have a lot of snow, so it's easy to imagine on the one hand all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas or all the snowflakes as millions of sentient beings. It's an example that we can see at sometimes of the years of millions. And then those people live in big cities. You don't have to imagine snowflakes. You have all the people all around you to imagine the vastness, you know, of all the people on the subway, all the people on the streets and the buses. So take this now and start with then you are now the Shantideva to be for the next generation. How would you, I mean, goodness, for the next generation, imagine going out to all the internet. So how do you want to see it?
Okay, thank you.
And did you have another question?
Kimmo?
Mm-hmm.
It's Judy Allen in Iowa.
Hi, Judy.
Hi. I thought this was so helpful. And part of what was really helpful to me is where you talked about finding a way to be honest with oneself about our past thoughts and deeds mm-hmm. and so on without harming ourselves,
mm-hmm.
without torturing ourselves and so on. And then you indicated at the end, there, he talks about how there's no difference in himself and others, no mm-hmm. I and so on. and it seems like those are somewhat connected,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. And I wonder if you have a recommendation for particular practices. It's not that, well, just practices that might, when one is being honest with oneself, how not to go on and on. And I think, for me, this is a difficult area because I was, as a very young person, was so, had so much exposure to very fundamentalist
mm-hmm.
Christianity. And I,
mm-hmm.
so I loved the way you talked about this and based on his chapter. And I'm wondering if you have
yes.
practices that we could, it wouldn't be really starting, but to really move through this.
Right.
Yeah.
So Judy was asking a really important question about how to go a little bit deeper into how to be honest with yourself without harming yourself. There are two things that have really been life-changing for me about this. One is to have confidence in the inner perfection. All of the books on Buddha nature discuss deeply, through logic and through example, how we couldn't have anything at our core other than a perfect Buddha nature. I find when I'm doing some of the work that can be a little painful, let me tell you, this is what solitary retreat is like. Anything you've ever done comes through your mind. So when those periods come up, reminding oneself and reading again and again that the inner perfection
mm-hmm.
is the core belief, and that's the foundation. That's tremendous. To really analyze what aggression is. So if you are harsh with yourself, that is strengthening aggression, right? And
mm-hmm.
so you want to question, do you, in your inner voices, want to strengthen aggression, or do you want to strengthen compassion and gentleness?
Mm.
So when we have our harsh inner voices, to acknowledge that that actually is a kind of aggression. And we get that confused with something that's good. We don't acknowledge it often as aggression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the third practice for me is, especially when something is very painful, to imagine if my best friend came to me with the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how kind and compassionate you would be if it was a child or a good friend who wanted to get something off their heart and wanted
mm-hmm.
to talk to you, how gentle you would be with them.
Mm-hmm.
And just to extend to yourself the same kindness you would to a friend.
That's helpful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that makes things a lot less scary.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That makes real sense.
Yeah, well,
good.
I have a lot of practice in those.
Oh. Well, thank you so much for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, really good, yeah.
Okay, so let's, and I thought it'd be nice to start using some of the dedications from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So one of the favorite dedications of the Dalai Lama, I'm sorry, I didn't write the verse number, but let me find it. It's like the four verses from the last one. Verse 55 in the 10th chapter. And now, as long as space endures, as long as there are beings to be found, may I likewise to remain to drive away the sorrows of the world.